imagine me and you. I do. I think about you day and night. It's only right. So happy together. If I should call you up, invest a dime, and you say you belong to me, ease my mind. Imagine how the world could be so very fine. So happy together. You and you and me, no matter how they toss the dice, it had to be. The only one for me is you, and you for me. So happy together. Me and you, and you and me, no matter how they
Hello.
Toss the dice.
Hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of Third Degree Burn. I am Tim Elliott, and tonight I have with me Kirk Greenfield.
Hello.
And Nigel Spink.
Good morning.
And today we are starting a new journey. We are going to start covering Alpha Flight, but we're going to do it by going through the X-Men first, because that is their first initial appearance. So tonight we are going to be covering X-Men number 109, and we'll follow that on future shows with X-Men 120, 121, and then 139 and 140. And then we'll go into Alpha Flight number 1 proper. Start covering that. And we'll cover that the way Kirk and I did Namor. So we'll cover that sequentially. We will cover issue 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So before we kind of get into that, Kirk, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about the first appearance. Now, Alpha Flight is not in this issue per se, but it does have a main character from Alpha Flight make his first appearance.
Yeah, my thinking was, when I think of the X-Men and the John Byrne run on the X-Men that runs roughly till about issue 144, as I recall, maybe it's 143, I think of this as just about the beginning, although technically I guess he started in issue 108. Correct me if I'm wrong. This feels like his first... I don't want to say solo work, but his first hands-on, he's you know, working with Claremont, and they're plotting the story together, whether or not he's getting credit. But it feels like he's shouldering the load now. Instead of finishing up an older story, this feels like the first John Byrne to me. So Alpha Flight was, as I recall reading this, not a factor. This is a story about Guardian or Vindicator, depending on how you want to define him. And there is, I just reread the issue just before we started. There is one reference where he says, I'll be back and I'll bring Alpha Flight next time, or words to that effect. So it's foreshadowed, although we don't know what that means. And I question whether Byrne and Claremont knew what that meant at that time. But my feeling is this is the first toe in the water for both Byrne and for Alpha Flight. And then it was only after the Byrne sequence had finished in about issue 144 that my subscription to the Uncanny X-Men kicked in, and I discovered that he had left the series. So I was very disappointed, because I had just gotten in on the tail end of the Days of Future Past adventure and the Demon with Kitty Pryde, the Demon Before Christmas, or the Night Before Christmas, or whatever you want to call it. So I was very disappointed. So my exposure to this story and to the Alpha Flight appearances was only because of a trade paperback that I found at a comic shop in about 1980, 81. The local comic shops in the Detroit suburbs were riding high. They were expanding, and you know, tremendous wave of popularity for the Teen Titans and the X-Men, and for soon Batman and Superman and what have you. There was a real resurgence in comics coming. So at the comic shop, sitting in the front window, was something called the X-Men Companion. And right next to it was the X-Men Companion Volume 2. I didn't know exactly what those things were, but I was so frustrated that I was no longer subscribed to Byrne's X-Men that I asked him to pull it out of the front window and flip through it. And it was a labor of love by people trying to capitalize on the popularity of X-Men. And they had excerpted panels in black and white in between interviews with all the principals, Claremont and Byrne and Austin and whoever else the editors were. And then they had illustrative panels or pages to demonstrate what they were talking about. So as I was flipping through this thing, lo and behold, here's this thing called Alpha Flight. And I had no knowledge of it at that point. So I was working backwards from that point to collect the prior 2.5 years. And believe me, this is before the internet. The only way that you could get those basically was to go from comic shop to comic shop to comic shop to try to find them in the back issue bins and decide whether or not you were going to spend your weekly paycheck or how much you were going to spend to get that particular issue or that issue. And, you know, some were much harder to afford or to find than others. But I eventually closed in on virtually all of them right back to about 94. Sorry, that was a little bit long-winded, but that was my exposure to Alpha Flight. Kind of I came in through the back door after it was all over, so to speak.
That's often how it's done when you read comics. You get an issue, then you want to know what happened before, so you scramble to find those prior issues. Mm-hmm. How about you, Nigel?
I was fortunate enough to, I'd already started reading the all new, all different X-Men. And I just got a kind of steady supply of each issue coming through because I'd found a local comic shop. Somebody started a comic shop up. And so I was just in the right place at the right time, as you might say. So, yeah, I got this issue that we're going to look at today as it came out, you know, as it came into the shop.
Nice.
I didn't know anything about, well, I guess we didn't know anything about Alpha Flight or even Weapon Alpha, as it was called at that time, until we read this issue.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was there at the start, yeah.
Kind of wish we had Brian on the show because Brian's our resident scholar. Byrne is so tied. Well, Byrne's obviously tied to Alpha Flight because he started the main run in the story, and that is that they told him if he didn't do it, somebody else was going to do it. And he thought, well, I might as well do it because I kind of created him. So I don't know how much is Byrne and how much is Claremont. Like in this case, for instance, when we see Vindicator in this, or Weapon Alpha in this issue, is that a wholly Byrne creation? Now, obviously, Wolverine's not. The fact he's from Canada is not. That was all already established. But Byrne being Canadian, did he come up with this Canadian hero to go up against Wolverine? And this ties into Giant Size number one, because he mentions, I'm getting ahead of ourselves, but that he mentions that, hey, I quit. You know, I'm a free agent. Canada has a different idea that we help create you need to work for us, you know. So again, I don't know how much is Byrne and how much is Claremont when it comes to these established
My
characters.
Bet is that it's quite a bit Byrne, but I don't know. I'm just thinking because of his Canadian pride and the fact that he was the Canadian representative on the creative team. I would think, especially the term major maple leaf, I think Wolverine throws that around some point. I just have the sense of it that it's his, but I really don't know.
Lovely listener,
if you do, let us know.
Yeah, that's a question for our listeners.
I'm the same. I assume that Byrne was the main guy behind these Canadian heroes, if you like.
Well, are you guys ready to get into the issue? Because Nigel, you have the synopsis. So
I do.
All right. Yep. So if there's no other business, I think we can jump into it.
Yeah, let's have a look. So we are looking today at the all new, all different X-Men issue number 109. Which has let me just a minute now. Not ready. Okay, yeah, X-Men 109, which has a cover date of February 1978, Its release date was November the 15th, 1977. And it was on sale at a whopping 35 cents, which was 12 pence in Britain. And the creative team was writer Chris Claremont, penciler John Byrne, inker Terry Austin, colorist Andy Yanchus, is that how you pronounce it? Letterer was Joe Rosen, and the editor was Archie Goodwin. Just for the history, other works of Byrne that were also out with a cover date of February 78 were Marvel Team Up number 66, which was Murder World. It was part two of the Spider-Man Captain Britain team up, and he was the artist. Power Man number 49, Seagate is a Lonely Place to Die. Again, John Byrne on the art. And then, of course, this issue, which he did, X-Men 109, Home Are the Heroes, which is the title of the story. So let's get into the synopsis, which goes like this. The X-Men at last return home after their adventure in the Shi'ar galaxy. Wolverine is in a hurry to shed Fang's uniform as he finds the alien fabric distinctly uncomfortable. They are accompanied by Lilandra, who is shown around the school. Phoenix reminisces about a moment that occurred just prior to returning to Earth, a brief conversation with Corsair, in which he asked her to never tell Cyclops that he is his father. Phoenix agreed, but stated that she feels she was betraying Scott by keeping such a secret from him. Storm, who overheard their conversation, warns Jean about keeping such vital information from the man she loves. In the present, however, Phoenix has a heart-to-heart with her parents. She reveals to them her recent experiences and her new identity as the Phoenix. From a distance, Scott observes them and thinks that to himself that Jean now seems like an entirely different person. Nightcrawler sees Scott, tries to break him out of his funk, but Scott snaps at him angrily. Nightcrawler then retorts at how difficult it is being born blue and furry. The X-Men take a well-deserved day off. Moira tells them of a lake in upstate New York where Charles and she once visited during their courtship. Moira, Sean, Aurora and Peter prepare for an outing. Misanthropic Wolverine elects to tag along in order to do some hunting. Storm is appalled and criticizes him for wishing to kill defenseless animals. Wolverine responds sharply that it takes no skill to kill and that he does not intend to use lethal measures. Storm apologizes, but Wolverine couldn't care less. Meanwhile, in Canada, James MacDonald Hudson, an agent of a Canadian government-sponsored defense program called Department H, dons a high-tech battlesuit and becomes Weapon Alpha. He flies to the United States on a mission to capture and retrieve a rogue agent Wolverine. James and Wolverine have a long history together, and he knows that he will be in for the fight of his life. At the lake, Storm and Colossus relax on the shore, taking in the sun, while Banshee and Moira play around in the water. Wolverine skulks about the surrounding area, tracking a small deer. Just as he comes in close enough to touch it, Weapon Alpha appears before him. Hudson refers to Wolverine as Weapon X and states that he is still the property of the Canadian government. Wolverine has no intention of returning to his former employers. He lunges at Weapon Alpha, slashing at him with his claws. The electromagnetic fields of Hudson's battlesuit protects him. However, He blasts the feisty mutant away with his repulsor weapons, sending him flying through the trees. Wolverine lands close to the lake, and the other X-Men snap to attention. Weapon Alpha engages Peter, who transforms into Colossus, and punches him back through the trees. Regaining control of his suit's flight systems, he turns back and unleashes a volley of electroblasts against Colossus. One of his shots ricochets off the hero's steel frame and hits Moira. Banshee goes berserk and pummels Weapon Alpha with a concentrated sonic scream. Hudson realizes that he cannot take Wolverine and his teammates by himself. Promising a rematch, he flies off and returns to Canada. And that's pretty much the end of this issue.
Well done.
Okay. And so Weapon Alpha makes his first appearance.
Yeah.
And I thought at the time that it was, he was a cool looking dude. Yeah. If you'd read the giant sized X-Men where Wolverine sort of resigned from his post as Weapon X, which I can't remember if I actually had read that by then, or by the time I read this or not, because I never read the giant-sized X-Men as it came out. I never got it, because I didn't find out about the new X-Men until about issue 97.
Well, the story implies
that
Vindicator Weapon Alpha, as he's called here, was present when Wolverine quit. Now, in Giant Size, which I have read, I don't know if anybody's mentioned by name, if he's just one of the characters in the background. But he seems like he was, with the way Wolverine talks about he was there.
The only person I can remember, really, there was Professor X, and there was a guy who Wolverine cut his tie off with his claws. Yeah. He was like the main guy in charge of the base. Yeah. I don't really remember anybody else being behind except for maybe a guard or something like that, a security type guard. I wouldn't have thought, well, I don't remember, but was it in when he did his X-Men Elsewhen, of course, they recapped all that, didn't they?
They did. And I think they retconned some of it.
Of course, Hudson is there then at the moment when he resigns, yeah.
Well, I think they do in Alpha Flight number 17, they kind of retell the same story, but from Hudson's point of view, or Wolverine's talking about it with, is it Heather? Is it Heather? That's his wife's name.
They're
talking about it, established more. They had more of a history that they kind of raised, like what they found him when he was feral, and they kind of raised him and made him civilized, that kind of thing. Talk about the cover here for a minute. I like the cover, which has been, I think, is it Alpha Flight 17 that mimics this cover?
Yeah.
Wolverine punching somebody. Kind of the other way around.
Burn does his version of this cover. Yeah. I actually like this one better than the Burn one, though.
Well, this is the time Cochran was doing a lot of the covers. But this is Terry Austin inking. And you can see I don't know if Austin is trying to make it look a little bit like Byrne, or what makes Byrne's X-Men look like that is Austin's inks. Because when you first look at this, you might think, oh, this is a Byrne cover. But then you can kind of look at it closer and you can see Colossus is a little different. Cochran always drew him slightly different. And everybody's a little beefier. Weapon Alpha is a little beefier the way Cochran liked to draw people, but it's a nice cover.
Kirk,
this issue, which is kind of confusing, if you read 108, then you read 109, they seem to transition right from 108, where they're going through the Stargate, whatever, to their to the X Mansion, but in between is the last issue of Iron Fist, number 15, where most of them show up, where they fight Iron Fist, because Iron Fist takes place right after they came back to Earth. They get in a tussle with Iron Fist over some stuff. Then they go back to the X-Mansion. So that kind of fits in between the these two issues.
Because Wolverine's still wearing that Fang costume, isn't he, in Iron Fist 15. Yep. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And apparently I read that Dave Cockrum, his intention was that Wolverine would keep the costume and he would use it.
Yeah.
But Byrne hated it, so he put him back. Mm. And they point out that when Byrne redesigns Wolverine's costume, it goes to the brown.
It goes to the colors,
Same color. Mm. Yeah, the same color scheme as the Fang costume.
Yeah.
And I forget until I read, you forget that they're such established as a team and kind of as a family that this is, when you read this, it's still early on. They're still kind of getting to know each other. Wolverine is still kind of surly with all of them because he doesn't. You made that comment that when Storm rebukes him about hunting, he's like, you guys have, been misjudging me the whole time, and I could really, I don't care what you think, doesn't bother me.
Yeah, I must admit, I mean, when I first read a comic with Wolverine in it, I thought, who's this guy? I didn't like him at all. And I don't think I'd warmed to him yet by this issue either. I still thought he was a bit of a pain in the ass.
Well, the same was the scene, which I thought was a nice scene between Kurt and Cyclops, and that Scott keeps calling him Nightcrawler, and he points out that I have a name. My name's Kurt Wagner. Because they said that when Phoenix was originally established, Claremont, his idea was that they were the same person. Phoenix and Jean, same person. And but Scott's comment here that she seems like a different person.
Yeah,
is foreshadowing. We find out later that really she's a duplicate.
Yeah, she was a different person. Yeah, there were one or two things actually that, funnily enough, came through Scott, which kind of finish up being correct when they resurrected Jean Grey.
Yeah,
and so I like that because for me, to me though, right from issue 101 when she became Phoenix and the. I thought this, there's something different about Jean now. Even though I would have probably thought at the time, it's still Jean's body. But I looked at it that she'd been taken over by some kind of, alien entity.
Yeah.
So she wasn't in control of herself all the time anymore.
Well, and they could have written it either way. It could be she's been replaced by the Phoenix entity, or she's being corrupted by all this power. So that's why she doesn't seem like herself. I do like on page 11 where you see outside the window and she just kind of flares up in front of her parents.
Yeah, she turns into Phoenix in front of them and they're like,
it's got to be startling. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. They're a bit shocked, but...
we got some stuff with Peter, which is him not, which they kind of glossed over in your synopsis that he's trying to write a letter home. He doesn't have the words for it.
And
I guess I'd forgotten that Nightcrawler had already had established his, he was dating Amanda at the time, that he had forgotten how quickly he was kind of had found, started a relationship with her. And he,
Cause you're talking about a double date. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And we get some, and it's interesting, I don't know if this was planned, but the flashback of them leaving and dealing with the Imperial Guard and Lalandra taking over because the Emperor is in a coma, or he's incapacitated, so she's going to be crowned. And that's what she tells him, that they, you have to leave the X-Men alone. And the whole story with Corsair and Jean, this conversation, that is not it's treated like a flashback, but we didn't see that at all in the previous issue. They just left. So we're kind of filling in what happened here, and we're getting to see it all as flashbacks. And then,
Did they not? There was something in the issue 108, though, about, she read his mind, didn't she, really?
Yeah.
That's how she found out. That's how she found out that he was Scott's father, because she read his mind.
But they didn't talk about, they don't, there's no consideration for what about Havoc? Sure, maybe he didn't want to tell, you can't tell one without telling the other one, but they don't consider Havoc at all, that he doesn't know.
That's true.
Who's the third? They introduced a third Summers brother, Vulcan.
I don't know much about, I'm aware of it, but I don't know anything really about it.
Gabriel Summers, aka Vulcan, is the long lost brother of Scott and Alex.
After my time.
What did you think of the way they have McTaggart, her dialogue as a Brit? Do you think they're catching her Scottish accent very well?
Let's have a look. I'm getting mixed up with the other way with the other ones where I in this, they've got her dialogue written in a way that, you're meant to read it, if you can, with the Scottish accent. The way they write the words in the word balloons, they're giving you the opportunity to read it like a Scots woman. Whereas I'm getting mixed up because John and I are doing the X-Men Hidden Years. We did one just recently, actually, and Moira's in that, and she's having a conversation with Jean, and in that, they've just written it normally, as if she would have a, no accent or an American accent or whatever. Because I thought, oh, that's different. They're not going with the Scottish, with the Scottish angle anymore. They're just writing it flat out, So it could be, I like that. I like that idea, how they used to write the words for Moira and for Sean with the Irish, the Irish brogue.
Well, they do it with, that's what I was liked about when they write Nightcrawler, they would throw in some German or Kurt Peter.
Wagner.
Throw in some Russian.
He's German in Nightcrawler. Russian. They were definitely then they were going for the accents. Which gives them more of a character,
Because they would. They would, they're speaking speaking English, but they would have it with a
And Wolverine with his A, Canadian.
That's one thing don't ever do. They don't ever give him really establish him with a Canadian accent. They do not, even in the movies with Hugh Jackman, they don't lean too much into that, They give him Bub. And stuff like that, but they don't. They don't. Same with Peter Parker. He's from Queens. He would probably have a heavy New York accent. They don't do that.
Heavier than a Brooklyn one, though.
I don't know. That's a question for Paul Spataro. I don't know. I just think it would be a definite New York accent.
It would. I guess.
And I also thought the something else they kind of left out of your they left it because the
synopsis was,
Storm comes in and she lives in the attic because she has all these plants.
Talking to the plants.
She whips up a little rainstorm, which can't be good for the inside of the house, to the point where it's even thundering and lightning. And she strips down. She's used to being, because she was treated as kind of a goddess and her homeland, so she strips down. She's naked, just enjoying the. And then later at the beach, we get the same. She has a conversation with Peter about why she feels she has to wear these little scraps of clothes because she's wearing like a bikini, and then she says it's this land's strange taboos. Basically, she just wants to lay around naked.
I wish I didn't have to wear these absurd scraps of cloth.
And says, remember what happened when you went swimming in the mansion?
In the mansion pool,
Mansion pool, yeah.
And obviously the professor told her off.
you can't just, walk around. It's dark. What did you think of the fight between Wolverine and Weapon Alpha?
It's a pretty good one, actually. I didn't think that the synopsis gave it the full treatment, as it were. Yeah. It's quite a good battle, yeah, because he bursts out of the ground in front of him, and Wolverine goes, Wolverine slashing away with the claws, There's some nice thought bubbles going on from Hudson all the time about, how he's looking at Wolverine, thinking he's faster than I remember, and good job I got my force shield up in time. That's all. And then he gives him a whack to the jaw. He hits Wolverine hard in the face, and Wolverine's trying to laugh it off, going, like, that didn't hurt. But then he's thinking to himself, big talk, that nearly took my head off. So they're having a good old battle there. And then I like the when he takes off, because Weapon Alpha can fly, and Wolverine goes, oh, cripes, you can fly. Damn it. That's like,
And when he's coming back at him, Wolverine kind of thinks.
Yeah, he goes, oh, God, he's coming in like.
Yeah, he's not cutting. When he cuts loose full strength, it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
And that's a nice, he just dives into it.
I'm going to hurt, and then wham, And then he throws him. Yeah, then they switch scenes, but then Wolverine's comes flying through the trees and crashes into a big tree, and he's more or less out for the count. To begin with, when he lands near Storm and Colossus. He's like laid out there on his back with his mouth open. He's like, ugh. But they, of course, intervene, gives him a chance to recover.
Yeah, and it shows that Hudson is not familiar with these people at all. He doesn't know any of the other X-Men.
They're not aware of. Well, he's not aware of the X-Men. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't know. And then he thinks they're just witnesses. And then And I love when Colossus, which is a great panel where he changes in full swing. He throws a punch and changes. And after he hits Hudson into some trees, he says, "Is before my eyes that clown turned to a man of steel."
Yeah.
And that's when he picks up a tree. And that's when Storm basically
zaps the tree with the lightning. And he's thinking, oh, Christ. Yeah, who the blazes are these people? Yeah. She called herself an X-Man. Talked like Wolverine was part of the group.
Well,
and
think
then, sorry, go on.
No, I said, you think they would be, because he recognizes Banshee from his Interpol fire.
Interpol,
But he doesn't recognize anything else. And I know the X-Men are kind of,
they're fairly the foreigners especially, they're fairly new, aren't they? Like Colossus from Russia and Nightcrawler's from Germany, and so they've not been in America that long.
No, well, it's true, this is issue 108, so it's been
109 but
we're 109, so it's been less than a year after Giant Size X-Men
and they've been kind of in space or whatever for part of that time. Or being just kept under wraps at the mansion. So nobody's going to know a lot about the new members at this point.
You think they would, I don't remember, when Banshee kind of went after Mori gets hit and he pulls her out of the river, and then he kind of goes crazy and kind of cuts loose at Hudson. And he says, he's cutting loose with so much raw energy, his sonic beam is liquefying whatever they hit. And that's when he's not sure his battle suit can withstand the punishment, so he decides to leave. I'm surprised they didn't have something in here about, because in the prior issue, Banshee had he strained himself attacking Joff, and he talked about how he had maybe pushed his power past his limit. And they didn't make it, I thought maybe they'd make a comment that, well, hasn't quite recovered, because later he loses his power, doesn't he? Is that then the Proteus storyline, or is that?
Well, no, he strains himself beyond repair with the one we did a few weeks back, where we were doing the one with the story in Japan with Moses Magnum.
Was that when he did it?
That's where he first kind of strained himself too much and lost his ability to to use the sonic scream. And I don't think it ever came back after that.
No, because I think he kind of leaves the team. He kind of hangs out on Moore's Island, and then
because he's not really in the Dark Phoenix story, is he? He's already pulled out of the team.
I don't know when they.
He's on Muir Island. Yeah, and he's on Muir Island. Yeah, with Proteus.
Right. That's when that. He's
in the story, but I don't think he's using his. Scream that I can remember.
Because when we covered the two Marvel team ups, which is Spider-Man and Thor, and Spider-Man and Havoc.
Right.
Some of that is on, because they mentioned in this story that Havoc and Polaris have gone to the island to get away from it all. And I think they're there when they capture Havoc, because that's the living Pharaoh. Thor story.
That's right.
I don't know when they bring in Siren, his daughter. I don't know when she becomes
Siren. I don't know when she first appeared. The first time I saw her was in a Spider-Woman issue, which also guest starred, I think, some of the X-Men. Somewhere around about I might be wrong with the number, somewhere around about Spider-Woman 38 or 39. That's the first time I saw Siren.
Yeah, you're right. Her first appearance is Spider-Woman 37 in 81.
Oh, that was close, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And because I think she got in with the wrong crowd. I think she was with Black Tom Cassidy and the Juggernaut. Oh. Yeah. But how she got in with them, I don't know.
She said she should date, or off topic, or she debuted as a villain in Spider-Woman number 37.
Yeah.
And Chris Claremont was the writer on that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was with Black Tom and Juggernaut, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was in the Fallen Angels series. I like this series. It's
I've not read any of those, but
read it. It's,
Going back to Gamble. This issue, did you spot the deliberate mistake next to the last panel on the last page?
Yeah. Where she's saying that Banshee.
Yeah,
she's talking Banshee.
And she says, "I agree, my friend." Oh, Banshee's signaling us back to the lake. And it's like, no, he's not.
He's not. He's right next to you. Yeah.
So it would either be Wolverine or Peter, wouldn't it? Who would be signaling them back to the lake. Yeah.
And the two panels before that, when this is Hudson talking to himself, but he disappears, which we later find out that his suit can negate the Earth's rotation. So it looks like he's disappeared, but he stays in one spot. The Earth keeps rotating, so it looks like he's become invisible. He just really just kind of looks like teleports.
That's how he just goes, pop. Yeah, when he disappears.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he says, next time to equalize the odds, I'll bring Alpha Flight with me.
Yeah.
That's the first mention of Alpha Flight. I would love to know. Again, maybe this is something our listeners can tell us, if Alpha Flight was anything just other than a throwaway line, or did Claremont and Byrne have an idea of creating another team? I know I've heard that Alpha Flight was created strictly as a team that could go up against the X-Men. There was no idea of making an ongoing group or book.
I mean, if I had to guess, and I'm only guessing, I don't know, but knowing what Byrne seems to be like, he comes up with ideas pretty quickly. And this is issue 109, so it's only about 10 issues before Alpha Flight is going to appear, and the writers and the artists are always working ahead of the actual issue that's just come out, aren't they?
Yeah.
So I would think that Byrne had already got ideas for, at least an idea of some of the team members, what they were going to maybe look like. He'd perhaps been drawing sketches for himself at that stage. So maybe they'd obviously thought of the idea because they mentioned Alpha Flight.
True. I know Byrne likes to work, when he comes, at least when he comes onto a book, he kind of has ideas, and that may be something you have to give your editor to say, okay, these are the storylines I want to accomplish over the next 12 issues or something like that.
Yeah.
So again, I don't know if Claremont worked that way or not, but I would think they would have to have, you would have to plan something with the editors and editor-in-chief where we're going, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, well, I see we have Kirk back.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes,
we can.
Oh, good. I'm sorry, guys. My computer apparently didn't like the microphone, and it muted me. I kept talking to you, and you were talking over me until finally I realized they're not hearing me. And there was a warning note that came up on my computer that said, something's wrong with your microphone. So,
not sorry. A problem. We thought maybe Weapon Alpha came and got you.
Well, it's funny because just as Nigel was wrapping up his synopsis, I said, good synopsis, except you left one thing out. And he totally ignored that. And I thought, did he not hear my pop? So that was the first clue.
No, I didn't.
I had away to look at the book online. And so I had been scrolling through the pages online, unaware that my mic had been muted until we got to that end. That was the first clue that something was wrong until you called on me, Tim. I'm very sorry.
I missed most of the
discussion.
No apologies. Well, tell it. We've kind of gone through a lot of it ourselves. Give us your impression.
Well, I found it kind of interesting because, as I recall, and I don't have the issue open in front of me now to try to save on computer processing space. That seems to be part of the problem. As I recall, Claremont and Byrne are taking pains to introduce each one of the characters now that they're back at the mansion and giving you backstory behind Colossus, behind Oro, behind Nightcrawler, behind Phoenix. They establish all of them. A couple of them they don't deal with. Professor X, they don't deal with. Lilandra, they don't deal with Oro very much, or Moria, much as I recall. But then when they get to the action with Weapon Alpha stalking Wolverine, much as Wolverine was talking about, hey, I want to stalk but not kill an animal, that's exactly what Weapon Alpha is doing. He's stalking Wolverine because he wants to capture him but not kill him. I saw a parallel there. The other thing is I also saw right at the end, I don't know if you see this, but when James Hudson fires an energy blast and it ricochets off from Colossus and strikes Moria, mm-hmm. I had an immediate flashback to the X-Men movie, the X-Men First Class. That is the same sort of scenario where Professor X loses the use of his legs. Now, I don't know if you guys saw that or not.
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, it's except that was that Magneto? Magneto reflected a bullet. And it hit.
Right. Well, it's a trope. Anything that ricochets has to hit somebody.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? If they're going to introduce a ricochet, it's going to hit somebody. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother telling you there was a ricochet going on.
Well, going back to Weapon Alpha wanting to bring in Wolverine, one, I don't understand why he came through the ground. I didn't know, because we see him in some kind of a vehicle in the shadows. Where he's got these guys that are tracking Wolverine to let him know where he's at. And then next thing you know, why he bursts to the ground, I don't know. I guess that's to be dramatic.
I don't think his power set was defined yet. You know, the Vindicator or Guardian or whatever you want to call him persona has not yet been defined. He's pretty much a blank check in this adventure, in this issue, where we don't know who he is. We don't know the background, although it's hinted that there's a history there. We don't know how he teleported away at the end. We won't know that for how long. Where do they introduce that? I don't know if it's in 20.
That's one of the Alpha Flight. Nigel and I were discussing that he had some kind of do with his control of the electromagnetic. He can cancel his inertia with Earth. So the Earth keeps rotating. He stays still. So it looks like he suddenly whisk away.
Pops. Right.
Yeah. why it pops. Yeah. But...
And, you know, good thing there wasn't a jetliner between him and wherever else. You know, he shredded meat real quick.
Well, they're a bit low for that, aren't they?
I like, well, yeah, I mean, for that matter, if he's just a little few feet off the ground and he suddenly renders himself inert to the rotation of the earth, he could go through a mountain.
Yeah.
Or, you know, pine tree or forest or, you know. So making a long story short, I don't think they knew what all he could do. I don't think he was clearly defined yet. I think this was the first, we'll leave a lot of loose ends here, and then we'll fill in the blanks later on in his next appearance or when he returns. Mm. Am I correct in saying the next issue, number 110, is that the fill-in issue with Cochran with Warhawk, or is it Warbird?
Yeah.
So that really doesn't flow. And the next time we pick up is Beast going, my stars and garters, what is going on here at this circus?
They're in a carnival, yeah.
You don't see them again until 120.
Mm.
I saw that issue on the stands, and I picked it up, and I flipped through it and went, holy smokes, look at this artwork. Colossus looks so realistic. Everybody looks so human. This is great. And like a fool, I put it back on the shelf and went off to class. I'll never forget that. I had it in my hands. It was the beginning of the great run, but I didn't buy it. I had sworn off comics while I was in college.
And when I first looked at that one, Kirk, I thought, have I missed an issue?
Yes.
Because like it starts with, with the Beast like going, oh, my stars and garters, and you're like, Beast? And what's that, you know, what's going on? And I knew that the previous issue was, you know, the one that had been done like a one-off with the Warhawk. And I thought, what the hell? Have I missed something? Has there been a special? Has it been crossed over with some other title? And I've missed the connection.
I was fortunate enough to interview Terry Austin, not quite at this time, but in the next, I don't know, 2 years or so. And as I was interviewing him for a cable TV program that I was putting together, I think I still have that half hour show on 3/4-inch tape somewhere. As I interviewed him, I asked him, what's your favorite type of story? And he says, you know what I really like? I like the stories that start out with a bang, where the reader goes, what's going on? Where am I? And he was directly referencing this issue. He didn't say it, but it's like in hindsight, I realize, wow, I got it from one of the three main primary creators. It's just a memory you triggered.
Kurt, you've been on this show for what, 2 years now?
I don't know, maybe.
Maybe. And that's the first I've heard that you've actually interviewed Terry Austin.
Terry Austin.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Terry Austin? Right? I mean, that's pretty cool.
Remember, I lived in Detroit after college for about 8 years. And about, I'm going to say, 3 of those years, I was working in the cable TV industry in the local origination department, which basically means we had the cameras, we had the studios, we had the videotapes, but we didn't know how to use them terribly effectively. It was a franchising tool to get the franchise signed on so that you could, you know, start making money. And then after a year or two, you'd rewrite the franchise and fire all those people and eliminate the studio. I mean, that was the business model. That's where it went. So I was working in cable TV, and I had access to, not a film camera, but basically was a VCR and a recording deck. And so one weekend I checked it out and I went to wherever Terry Austin was. I think he was at a swap show run by Michael Lester. And that's also how I met Tim Dazan at this same time, the same time period. So I got an interview with, Terry. He was very personable. It was a wonderful conversation. Interviewed various people at the swap show. And then I stitched it all together. I had no idea how to make a half-hour documentary, but I basically transcribed all the shots and stitched it together and edited it together and finished it and turned it over to the cable TV company. And they aired it once or twice and said, okay, that's it. It's our property now. And I kind of went, wait, I put all this love and effort into it and I don't own the copyright. No, I'm sorry. You used our equipment. So it's like, oh,
well, it's no difference. You creating a character from Marvel. They're going to be like, that's a Marvel character.
So the end result is they think they still have the videotape, but they might not.
Well, reach out to Mr. Austin and use your connections and maybe we get him on the show.
God, this was, you know, you're talking 30 years or more ago, folks,
you,
40 years.
I'm sure he remembers you.
Oh, he might remember the interview, but I'm just one of many, many, many.
That's still cool. I mean, that's a very cool thing, Kirk.
But you found Tim
about how he had to soak his hand from inking when he had a rush job because his hands would ache so much. He'd have to put them in a pan of hot water and rest for 5 or 10 minutes before he could dry it off and then get back to the inking.
Wow.
I remember that vividly. I don't know if I included that in the documentary that I did, but I thought to myself, geez, it's not all that much fun being an artist then.
When you're up against deadlines, you have to finish it. You can't stop. Did you say met Timothy Zahn, as in the guy that wrote the Heir to the Empire stories?
Tim DeZahn, who inked the
the
Avengers West Coast.
Two and a half years. Right.
But he was a young kid, basically just about to graduate from high school, if he hadn't already. Lived in Hamtramck. I think he still has family in that area. And I have reached out to him, but I think we've had some trouble reaching an agreement to have him come on the air. I mean, he's willing, but things in his life are unsettled right now. So yeah. I have hopes, but I never thought about getting Terry Austin. I don't know I honestly don't know
if he still does inking and what, because I don't know if he was. Because he's so associated with Byrne that I don't know who else he usually partnered with.
I think he has family in the general Detroit area. I can't tell you what suburb. I mean, to people in Detroit, where you live, the name of the suburb tells you just a whole lot about their social economic background and their status. I mean, I don't know if that's true in Boston or in New York, but at least in Detroit, where you live really means a lot. And the further you get away from Detroit, the more upper class you are, the higher income, so to speak. I sorry if this is crude, but it's the truth. At least it was true in the 80s. And therefore, everybody was trying. White flight was a thing. You were moving away from the inner city and leaving it to the low income and the criminals and the drug traffic. And, you know, the end result is I don't know where his parents lived in that general area, but my sense was that they were in one of the outer suburbs and that he was in town to visit them. And we just happened to get him for this show. And he granted me very graciously an interview on about a half hour of his time. So
I'm looking at his wiki. It doesn't show he's got any work really past any of the 2000s, although I'm sure he's inked the, there's a couple of things, but
is he still alive?
Yeah.
Does the wiki? Okay.
He's probably in his, he was born in 52. So he's,
he's younger than I am.
He's from Detroit. He's from there Detroit, Michigan. Okay. Yeah, that's why. But he now lives in Poughkeepsie.
Okay.
But something he did write and he did a couple pencils. He doesn't pencil much. He's mostly inking. Yeah. But he wrote and inked the Dark Horse adaptation of Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which I have. I didn't realize that was Austin writing it and inking it. But I love that book. It's an Alan Dean Foster book. Anyway, back to our main story here.
Is he inking this issue?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think he
inked everything. So it wasn't really a tangent.
No, it wasn't a tangent. and we did discuss the cover, because the cover is Cockrum, but it's Terry Austin inking, and you can see he's kind of made it look a little like Byrne. It's got Byrne's influence on some of the inking, even though it's a Cockrum cover.
Yeah, I would have guessed that it was Byrne, to tell you the truth.
Yeah,
but when you stop and look at it, I think you're right.
The Colossus gives it away. That's the Colossus looks like Dave Cockrum. And I think Vindicator, as I said, it looks a little beefier than normal.
Right.
And that's probably Cockrum liked to do.
And I, in Wolverine on the cover, I haven't turned the issue upside down, but I have the sense that that face and that, what do you call it, his cowl, or his, cowl is the best word, I guess.
Yeah. I was just doing that now when you said you're not turned it upside down. I've just done that. And yeah, what you're about to say, yeah, you can see that's not burn.
Somebody had said in the past that Cochrane's favorite character was Nightcrawler, and that you can tell because he's featured so prominently. Maybe I've gotten this wrong. It may be Claremont's favorite character was Nightcrawler, but I don't think that's true. I think it's Cochrane.
Yeah, who liked him, I think you're right.
And Colossus. But when the change in artists occurred, Byrne's favorite character was Wolverine, and so the spotlight shifts over to him, and we get a lot more background on Logan over the next several issues. And Nightcrawler and Colossus are basically just additional characters. They're just background characters.
Well, Nightcrawler is a whole creation from Cockrum. He brought him over from either a failed DC story, or he was going to be a Legion of character or something, He had, and that there are other characters. You see some of the people in the Imperial Guard are characters, but Colossus. I mean not Colossus. Nightcrawler costume, everything. It's exactly just pulled him from that failed concept and just dropped him into the X-Men.
That's right. And as you mentioned, Byrne. I think you're right on. In the opening shot, you've got Wolverine grabbing his collar and starting to rip off that outfit. And what's he say? I can't wait to get out of these alien threads. It's like shades of the symbiote and Spider-Man. there's an interesting tie. But I don't think he liked that. But he does show up in that costume. What is it? Iron Man 15? You guys have already covered this part of the
costume. Iron Fist, number 15. He's in it, yeah. And that,
I liked that costume. And I thought it was pretty snazzy way to change up Wolverine's outfit, although I didn't understand why. I liked it myself.
Yeah, it could have been. Well, and it's interesting, if you look at the Iron Fist 15, that's drawn by Byrne, but it's not inked by Austin. So the artwork is not, it looks almost like it's early Byrne. It's just to do the anchor is not up to Terry Austin's level to make it look as beautiful. I mean, this is, we really hadn't talked about it, but this has got some gorgeous artwork in it. It's very detailed, lots of backgrounds. I know on a recent show you guys recorded, you talked a lot about how Byrne had a reputation for not drawing backgrounds, but these backgrounds are very full, very detailed, and they're not big panels.
He wanted the gig real bad.
Yeah.
Depending on who you talk to or where you read in various interviews, you get different flavors of whether somebody wanted to slide Cockrum out so that they could get back on schedule and do a more regular book, or exactly what the office politics were. But I had the impression that Byrne was hungry and he wanted a regular mainstream book that was being published monthly. He wanted to show his chops. He had ideas, and therefore this is really his opportunity to shine.
Well, and especially how quickly he becomes co-plotter. So he's probably at this point, even now, contributing ideas. And Byrne has said in interviews, and I've heard him say it myself at cons, that I think I asked him once at the Boston con, I said, if you could only do one thing, write or draw, what would it be? And he said, it would be write. He goes, I consider myself a writer who draws. So first and foremost, he thinks of himself as a writer. So I think to your point that, he's hungry to do the artwork, but he's also, this is an opportunity that he can get his ideas and stories and concepts someplace where, he has enough clout that he can kind of start to, depending on what you believe or not, how he might be taking over more of the plotting and writing, or at least plotting later on between him and Claremont
towards the end of his run. I wish Brian was here to share some of the background, but
I know.
My understanding of Byrne's background is that he Roger Stern, and somebody else. Was it Bob Layton? I'm not sure, but there were three of them that came out of something. I'm not going to get the call letters right, but it's something like CPL, which was a publication out of Indiana or Illinois. Well,
they came out of Charlton. I know Layton there, came out of Charlton.
Yeah, but CPL, Contemporary Pictorial Literature, I think that's what it stood for. I don't have any of those issues, but I understand that the passion that was burning in the 70s amongst those kids, I'm going to say, who were just coming out of college or out of art school to make it into comics, there was a nucleus of people, and Byrne and Stern, and there was one other one. I'm not sure that it's Bob Layton, but it might be. They all came from that same bullpen, for lack of a better word, and they all made it big. And their success inspired Willington, the guy who did McAllister Wolverine, one-armed man, an amazing artist. Tim DeZahn, the guy who did the kitchen sink. I've drawn a blank here. The Megaton Man. All these people were inspired by the success of that CPL group getting in. And so once you saw other fans were getting in, you were willing to try your hand to try to get in as well. And I suppose if you take that trend to its ultimate extreme, you get the boys from Image, or who became Image, to come in and flex their muscles and then walk out. All right, enough of that tangent. Sorry.
No worries. Anything further on this issue? I think we've kind of given it. Oh, I did read that that the relationship in the book where it's mentioned between Charles and Mora, that it was revealed that they had a working relationship, but in this book, it's kind of hinted that they had a romantic relationship prior.
Yeah, I got that. Mm. When she said, this is the lake that we used to visit when we were, was it the term? Was it when we were courting? I don't recall the exact wording, but yeah. And then there's that smooch between Banshee and Moria where he says, hey, welcome home. And before she can finish her sentence, he's planted a big wet one right on her. Boy, that wouldn't fly in today's society. No. Holy smokes.
Well, he says, shut up and kiss me, darling. Then before she can object, he kind of grabs her.
Also, hey, when she gets hit by that ricochet, we never come back to that as I recall. Nobody says, oh, she's going to be fine. It was just a grazing shot. Nobody says, oh, my God, there's head trauma, or we got to get to the emergency. We don't revisit that. I had wondered if that was a loose thread, that was going to be spun off into some other storyline, that she was going to become something as a result of that. What? I have no idea. But it just felt like it was one of Claremont's loose ends that he was going to pick up on later on, and nobody did. Did you get that feeling?
I honestly don't. I mean, Banshee does mention that she's knocked out. She's got a bad burn across her forehead, and she might have a concussion. I don't know. I can't remember if in the following issues, if it's brought up, if she's got a bandage
I don't think it is. I just think it's totally forgotten.
And it may be. But, well, because that's not the main, because it's more about, because they're asking who Weapon Alpha was. And he's like, oh, it used to be, we were almost brothers. But, and this is just the beginning, from here on it, things are going to get worse. Meaning they've introduced this guy. He could come back, and he does with Alpha Flight. But so,
does this issue? What does this issue tease in the next issue box? I don't have it in front of me. But what do they say is coming next?
Shadow
of the Gun. So they must have known they were going to run.
But there's at the bottom of the letters page, there's a little mention because it says next issue, special guest artist Tony DeZuniga steps aboard to give John Byrne and Terry Austin some badly needed time to get this first look in a book back on schedule. and the X-Men find themselves up against the strangest and deadliest foe of their career, the mansion they've come to call their home.
Okay.
So that's the write for the next issue.
So they knew that they were going to sequence it this way, but okay, that's interesting. Mm. No, I don't have anything else to share, I guess. I pulled enough rabbits out of the hat. Sorry.
No, I don't. Nigel, do you have anything, final comments?
Just that I would say that this is the first appearance of the first character that's going to become Alpha Flight. And excuse me. And that's it. Yeah, we've pretty much covered what he does and why he does it. And that's it. And off he goes. And at this point, he's just called Weapon Alpha.
Which I guess that's supposed to, he's Weapon Alpha.
And Wolverine's Weapon X. So yeah, it's just part of their, the government setup, their secret.
Surprised they don't call him Weapon Omega. So you have Alpha and Omega.
That's coming later.
Yeah, but that's coming, in a way. But at that time, we probably didn't think any more about it other than what.
He could have been, he could have been a throwaway.
Other than what he said is he might be back with Alpha Flight. But then with the stories that are coming up immediately after this, with the stuff that goes on, you would not, you'd be excused for kind of forgetting all about this little excursion, until you get to the next story where they appear again.
I think when we get to Alpha Flight proper, it's the retconned or established that Wolverine was in Alpha. He was supposed to lead Alpha Flight, wasn't he, before he left? Mm. And at that time, they had Alpha Flight, is it Beta Flight, and then Omega Flight, the three levels.
Gamma.
Gamma
Flight as well,
Right. Mm. Because in Alpha Flight 1, I think Puck gets promoted from second, is it Beta Flight or whatever Gamma Flight?
You're right. Yeah, you're right.
Is it Beta? The second.
Shuffled.
Right.
Cards get shuffled, and that's how we get
spoilers. Spoilers.
Alpha Flight. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's spoilers, but we're going to cover it anyway.
It's all coming up.
So we will continue. We discussed this when we were going to tackle Alpha Flight. Should we start with the first Alpha Flight book, or should we do these X-Men books and cover all the appearances? Because they are by Byrne as well. So Facebook said, no, start at the beginning. So I thought it's best to start with this, and then we will, as I said, we will continue with issue 120 and 121.
121,
That'll be which we've actually already covered, Brian and I have. So we'll recover that one with a larger group. And then we will continue with 139, 140. And then we'll get into Alpha Flight proper. And we'll just cover that probably two issues at a time, the way Kirk and I did Namor, and the way you and John are doing X-Men Hidden Years.
Yeah. We'll
do all...
If I can just suggest, though, that because of the way it starts with a double-sized issue, it might be best to do number one on its own.
Right. One will be, I think that's how we did Namor.
Yeah. And then based on the story that follows, though, 2, 3, and 4 are all part of the same story.
And we might cover it that way, if that makes sense, because I know the first dozen issues or so have backup stories.
They've got the origins of the characters, as well.
So we need to decide if we're going to include those, or we'll do those separately, maybe on their own. So we haven't quite ironed it out. We don't know,
but no,
we'll try to cover them in the big arcs as we can. I'm looking forward to it. I'm kind of excited to see the next 120, 121, because like I said, Brian and I have already covered it a couple years ago. And to get a fresh take on it.
Yep.
Sounds good.
Good. Well, if there's nothing else further, Kirk, why don't you tell people where they can get a hold of us?
Oh, dear. Let's see if I remember. you can, of course, write to us at gottagetburned@gmail.com. Or you can go to the Facebook page, which is Third Degree Burn. That's probably the fastest way to get a response from us, because I think most of us are monitoring that Facebook page almost daily. There's something called Apple Tunes, formerly iTunes. Now it's Apple Podcasts. Thank you. I understand that's another way. And I've run out of ideas. What else do you guys suggest?
Facebook is the quickest, the best way, because that's where we will download the links. When a new show comes out, it'll go out to Facebook first, unless you've got it in your podcast aggregate, so it automatically goes to your device. Facebook is the best way to know. That's we give hints of upcoming shows. Kirk has been great of doing little teaser panels. So is Nigel for your upcoming shows with John. So that's the best way to know what's coming out and to get a hold of us. Or if you want to suggest something, Facebook is probably the quickest and the most direct way to contact us. And we try to do a show. We've been pretty good on schedule-wise. We try to put a show out every 2 weeks. They usually post on Sunday. Now sometimes if we do a special show or something like that, that may post on a Friday or during the week. If we do a cocktail, we do cocktail and comics, which is a kind of a off-topic show we do that just, it could be any random subject, and those are recorded and there's no kind of agenda for those. It's just a shoot the breeze kind of session. Those get recorded irregularly and they get released whenever we get one. But
okay.
I think that's it. So I want to thank everybody. I want to thank both my co-hosts for graciously coming on and spending Sunday night, Monday morning with me. So thank you, Kirk. Thank you, Nigel. And so for Third Degree Burn, I am Tim Elliott.
I'm Kirk Greenfield.
And I'm Nigel Spink.
Vindicator. She didn't ask you out here, Wolverine. I did. Been a long time, little man.
Not nearly long enough.
You may have deserted our team to work for Xavier, but you belong here. I've come to take you back.
Yeah? You and what army?
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the 22 Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's GOTTAGETBYRNED@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.